I'd like to tell you about a new podcast that I've recently discovered, and I know you're going to love it. If you want to learn Spanish and connect with the 572 million people who speak Spanish around the world, then you should definitely check out the Learn Spanish con Salsa podcast. Every week, Tamara Marie brings you one step closer to fluency by making language learning fun and effortless. Learn Spanish con Salsa immerses you in Latino culture and teaches Spanish through music and conversation. Delete all of those boring robotic language learning apps and listen to authentic Spanish you can use in conversation with real people. Subscribe to the Learn Spanish con Salsa podcast now and hear a new episode every Tuesday. Just search for Learn Spanish con Salsa wherever you're listening to Morbidology. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. In 2003, Diana and Robin Garbutt moved to the picture postcard village of Melsonby, North Yorkshire, which is located in the heart of the Yorkshire Dales. They were attracted to the area by the tranquility. There was very little other than rolling fields, a pub, a post office and a village shore, and a stream meandering through the centre. However, in 2010, their ideal was abruptly shattered. And the investigation would reveal that not everybody is who they portray themselves to be. Diana Garbutt and her husband, Robin Garbutt, lived in Melsonby, North Yorkshire. The couple were originally from York but had moved to the area in 2003 to run the local post office and store. The couple lived in the flat directly above the post office, and they had gotten married in April of 2003, around a month after they moved to Melsonby. According to those who knew them, they were an extremely devoted couple who took pride in their work. As Linda Sharp, who worked in the shop, said, "They were like the glue that held everyone together. Everybody loved them." Following in her father, William Kiefer's footsteps, who was a sergeant in the US Air Force, Diana had served in the British Army from 1990 to 1997 with the Women's Royal Army Corps and 2 Close Support Regiment. She had been brought up in Eggborough, North Yorkshire, where she attended Whitley and Eggborough Primary School, Brayton High School, and then Selby College. Diana and Robin had moved to the quaint village for a more slow-paced lifestyle. In their free time, they enjoyed camping, mountain walking, tennis, and socialising with their friends. Diana's mother, Agnes Gaylor, said that Diana had the best sense of humour, and said that she was also considerate and kind. She said that Diana was happiest in her life when she married Robin, and they moved to the village. Agnes and William had separated when Diana was much younger, and her father lived in the United States. As a matter of fact, Diana and Robin were in the process of planning a big vacation to the United States to go and visit family. They had planned to visit Diana's sister, Victoria, who lived in California, and her grandmother, Rose, who lived in Virginia. Speaking of Robin, Agnes said, Robin was very much a people person. He'd speak to anybody. He'd have time for everybody. The 23rd of March 2010 started out like any other regular morning for the couple. Robin opened up the store at around 4:30 a.m. and worked in the shop before opening up the post office at 8:30 a.m. As she did most mornings, Diana slept in. According to Robin, it was only moments after he opened the post office counter that he was disturbed by a man who came from the flat upstairs. He described the man as standing between 5 feet 11 inches tall and 6 feet tall. He was wearing a black balaclava, a dark blue long-sleeve t-shirt, and dark blue or black jeans. He was carrying a gun which he held down at his side. The man shouted at Robin, "We've got your wife," before ordering him to switch off the lights, lock up the shop, and not do anything stupid. He then ordered Robin to open up the safe. Robin complied, and the man then ordered Robin to fill his black holdall with money, which Robin did. The safe had contained more than £16,000. The man grabbed the holdall and then fled from the building. When he left, Robin rushed upstairs to check to see if Diana was there. Here, he discovered the lifeless body of his wife in bed, surrounded in a puddle of blood. At 8:38 a.m, Robin called 999.
Ambulance, what's the address of the emergency?
It's the corner shop, 2 East Road, Milsonby.
Sorry, could you just repeat that for me? It's a really bad line.
Sorry, it's the corner shop.
Yeah, is that the old post office?
That's it, yeah.
And then that's East Road?
Yeah.
In which town?
Milsonby.
Milsonby. Could you confirm the telephone number you're calling?
Oh, God, it's 01325. My wife's been attacked.
She's been attacked? Is the attacker still nearby?
No, he's gone.
Were any weapons involved or mentioned?
I think the guy with me, he had a gun, and he said to me...
He had a gun, sir.
The guy who came with me said he did have a gun, and he said, "Don't be stupid, we've got your wife. He's gone, I've come upstairs."
Has your wife been shot?
I don't know, I would have heard a gun.
Both paramedics and North Yorkshire Police rushed to the scene, but Diana was sadly already dead and could not be revived. She had been beaten over the head with some kind of heavy object. Detective Superintendent Lewis Raw quickly announced that they were investigating whether there was a possible link with a robbery which had taken place at the store almost exactly a year beforehand. In that robbery, two masked men stormed into the shop with a replica gun and threatened Robin. The replica gun would be found by Yorkshire Police, but the men were never identified. Shortly after that incident, the couple considered leaving the village, and at one point had even put up the business for sale. But then they decided to stay. Detective Superintendent Ross said, "Obviously, there are similarities with the crime that we are investigating at the moment, and that is a line of inquiry that we will be progressing." Police urged the public to keep an eye out for any clothing which fit the description of the killer or the mask that he was wearing, and to get in contact if they saw anything. They also asked if anybody saw anything suspicious in the area between 4 a.m. and 9 a.m. to reach out and let them know. It would have been a fairly busy time in the village, with children going to school and adults travelling to work. In a statement they said, "We are appealing for anyone who may have seen a suspicious or unknown vehicle in the village, or saw one leave the village at that time, or if you saw a man dressed in dark clothing and wearing a mask, to come forward." Police described the holdall as black in colour, with two loop handles on the top, made of shiny plastic with an open zip. They said that the holdall may have a towel inside. The post office and shop remained closed and cordoned off as North Yorkshire Police searched the bins and streams in the surrounding area. Police divers searched along a shallow creek which ran through the village. Meanwhile, police asked Richmond District Council to suspend rubbish collection until further notice. They wanted to make sure that if the killer had disposed of anything in a bin, then it wouldn't be taken to landfill. Police officers also conducted door-to-door inquiries and searched in drains and in local gardens. Police canvassed the area and made contact with people who worked and lived in the immediate vicinity. All of them said that they hadn't noticed anything strange or suspicious until ambulance and armed police arrived on the scene. Every weekday morning, a school bus would arrive in the village centre at around 8:30 a.m. to transfer children to school. The area is usually quite busy with children and parents waiting for the bus. Bill Nixon, who ran a garage opposite the post office, said that at about 8:30 that morning, there were around 40 children and parents congregating in the area. In fact, Linda Lynn, who worked in the shop, which was part of the post office, said that she never heard a thing. In the aftermath of the murder, the area outside the post office became a makeshift memorial for Diana. Floral tributes and cards of condolences piled up on the pavement. Many wrote tributes to Diana and recalled fond memories. One read, "Our world has been turned upside down. We will remember all the happy times we spent working together." While another read, "I will never forget the great day we had at Go Ape together. I do not think I would have done half of the assault course if it was not for you. You will be dearly missed." Such a senseless murder is disturbing for any community, but especially for such a quaint little village. The community was very tight-knit, and it isn't an exaggeration to say that everybody knew each other. One woman who didn't want to be named said to York Press, "They were just the nicest people you could ever meet. The most genuine people. All the kids around here just loved them." Linda Sharp, who worked part-time in the shop, said that Diana was a lovely woman and that Robin would be so devastated that she said he probably wouldn't be able to return to the shop. Another woman spoke with On Demand News.
"I've known her all my life. She's my best friend, and it's just so wrong."
Yorkshire police were quick to state that Robin had been left distraught by his wife's murder. They said that he had been cooperating and providing as much information as possible while they were doing everything they could to support Robin throughout the investigation into his wife's murder. Just the day after the murder, Diana's mother, Agnes, made a tearful plea for information on national television.
"She was content. She loved her life. She didn't deserve to be taken like this. Nobody does, but she of all people did not deserve to be taken this way."
She said, "The person who has taken my Diana's life has also destroyed my life, her husband Robin's life, and the lives of so many other people who adored her." Agnes said that Diana loved her life and said that the last few years living in Melsonby had been the happiest of her life. She said that somebody knows the person who committed the murder and asked people to check for blood on a loved one's clothing or to notice if somebody had been spending a bit more money than usual. She was supported by her partner, Michael Hodgson, as she said, "Catching them won't bring my daughter back. But if you know anything which could catch and stop the killer from hurting anyone else, please speak out now and contact the police." On the Sunday after the murder, churchgoers packed into the nearby St. James Church, where Reverend Stan Haworth comforted them. He said, "At the centre of this village, there is a crossroads. At that crossroads, there is a place where something tragic occurred. It has shocked us all as a community." He said that among the feelings of shock and heartache, there were feelings of anger and distress within the community. He urged those in attendance to pray for the community as well as pray for Diana and her family. A condolences book was opened and was filled very quickly. Following the service, police announced that they were trying to track down a white Ford Transit, or box van, which was seen parked near the post office between 4 a.m. and 9 a.m. They also announced that they were wanting to speak to people from Moore Road or St. James's Close, as well as all motorists who drove through the village that morning or used the shop that morning. Moore Road runs past the post office, while St. James Close was located behind the post office. The following day, police were out canvassing the area once again. They carried out an early morning census of traffic travelling in and out of the village. Outside the post office, local Safer Neighbourhood team inspector Ian Thompson made a fresh appeal for witnesses. He said, "Diana's husband Robin and family are distraught and continue to receive support from North Yorkshire Police at this very difficult time, working on behalf of Diana's husband, family and the community in which they lived. We are determined to bring Diana's killer to justice, but we need the assistance of members of the public to help us do this." A number of villagers spoke with the Northern Echo to reveal what kind of questions they had been asked by the police. Some said the police had asked them whether they had body piercings or whether they plucked their eyebrows. They were also asked for information about who lived next door. On the 1st of April, Robin released a public statement through the police. It said, "The past week has been extremely difficult and traumatic for me. Di was my life and I am lost without her. I would like to express my gratitude for the support of my family, friends and the police. I now ask that the media respect my privacy." Just days after the announcement, police announced that forensic examination at the Garbud home had finally been completed. The crime scene tape around the home and post office was removed, but police said that they were still conducting house-to-house inquiries. Police remained tight-lipped in regards to whether they had a suspect or not, or whether they had determined whether the murder was linked to the earlier robbery. However, just the following week, there was an unexpected and disturbing twist in the case when it was announced that Robin had been arrested in connection with Diana's murder. When announcing the arrest, police said, "The tragic death of Diana Garbutt 3 weeks ago has had a significant impact on people living in Melsonby for a while. It has also captured the concern and sympathy of the wider community due to the high level of media coverage of this case." Robin was taken to police headquarters to be interviewed. He took the police through the morning of Diana's murder.
"I'm in the post office. Knowing me, it would be slightly open. And I heard a noise. And I thought it was Diana coming to the shop. Or don't make it from the noise sometimes. You know, I kind of listen for Diana because normally the alarm system would go beep, beep. Normally either acts as a signal saying the kids have gone. So I heard that. So I come, I go, "Hi, Dad." I come out of the shop and there's a guy there. Anyhow, somebody stood there and he just said, "Oh, no, do you know what? I knew straight away I was going to be robbed. I just knew it because I wasn't really worried, you know? It sounded so stupid, but the first time I was absolutely shitting a brick, and this time, the first thing he said to me straight away was, he said, "Don't be stupid, we've got your wife." And he said, "Turn the lights off and lock the door." So I went back to our living bit, around the corner in our living bit, the lights. So I turned the lights off and I walked over to the door. I just bolted and locked it because, you know, the key just locked, bolted it. And I came back. He handed me a black hole door and he said, "Put the money in the bag, I think. I'll put the money from the safe. Put the money in the bag," I think he said. So I just walked into the post office. He followed behind me, handed him the bag. I think he said, "Stay there." He just walked out, and I heard the front door.
The following day, police were granted more time to continue their interview. In the UK, there's a 36-hour time limit on the length of time before police must release a suspect on bail discharge them, or apply to the magistrates for more time. Just the following day, Robin was charged with Diana's murder. He was ordered to appear at Northallerton Magistrates Court the following morning to be formally charged. The arrest completely stunned the community, who all said that Robin and Diana were a loving and happy couple. Robin's father, who lived in Clifton, York, said that he felt shock, horror, and disbelief that his son had been arrested and charged with murder. The next day, Robin appeared in court and was formally charged with Diana's murder. He showed no emotion as the charge was read out. He was then ordered to appear in Teesside Crown Court, to appear before a Crown Court judge and enter his plea to the charge. Outside of court, Robin's barrister, Jamie Hill QC, said that his client would most definitely be entering a not guilty plea. With Robin behind bars, Diana's funeral was to be held at St. James Church, near the post office. Diana's family said that flowers were welcome, but also said that if preferred, then donations could be made to the Yorkshire Air Ambulance in Melsonby Church. In the morning, Diana's heartbroken family gathered outside the post office and store as they waited for her coffin to arrive. As the hearse pulled up, the family walked behind as they made their way to the church. The procession was led by Reverend Stan Haworth. Around 300 people packed into the church as Diana's coffin was slowly carried in. Flowers accompanied the coffin with heartfelt notes such as, "From all your colleagues at the post office," and "Dear Diana, always missed, never forgotten." Standing at the front of the church, Reverend Haworth told the mourners that over the past couple of weeks, he had been asked numerous times about the reaction to Diana's murder. He said that his reply was always the same: bewilderment. He said that the funeral was a time for villagers to give thanks for Diana's life, but also was a time to comfort each other during the hour of need. He spoke about Diana and said that she was a special person who had touched the lives of many. He also spoke on behalf of Diana's family. Speaking for Agnes, her mother, he said, "I can't imagine my life without Diana. She loved a party and a good laugh. That's how I will remember Diana, always laughing." Diana's sister, Victoria, who lived in the United States, fondly recalled how she and Diana were the very best of friends. She said that in her heart and in her son Rowan's heart, Diana would live on forever. During the service, they sang hymns and read out prayers and Bible readings. There was a moment of reflection while the Bette Midler song, "The Rose," emanated from the speakers. The service was followed by a private cremation at Darlington Crematorium. Lockdown has been tough for all of us, but I've found myself a brand new hobby: jigsaw puzzles. I'm lucky enough that Unidragon have sponsored this episode of Morbidology. At unidragon.com and unidragon.eu, you can get yourself premium sets of wooden jigsaw puzzles. They offer jigsaw puzzles for both adults and children to entertain all experience levels. What I love about their jigsaw puzzles is how beautiful they are. They're perfect for people who love animals, with names like the majestic wolf, the inspiring unicorn, and the charming owl. Jigsaw puzzles are a great way to pass the time. It's a fun, low-stakes activity which can help reduce anxiety and even increase your memory and problem-solving skills. Also, it's super satisfying when you finally complete one. So head on over to unidragon.com or unidragon.eu, or click the links in my show notes and check them out. If you're like me, sometimes you need a break when listening to true crime. Well, what could be better than a mobile puzzle game filled with cute characters? I'm sure you've already heard of Best Fiends. There's over 100 million global downloads. It truly seems like everybody is playing it, and I think that you should too. They've even sponsored today's episode of Morbidology. As you make your way through the levels, you collect cute little monsters that you can evolve. Best Fiends is super easy to follow and fun to play, making it the perfect game for both adults and children. It's a casual game that won't stress you out, and it's very easy to pass the time with. I find myself playing it before bed, and when I'm out walking my dog. I'm already on level 261. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R, Best Fiends. Towards the end of June, Robin appeared in court once again, where he entered a not guilty plea. The trial was scheduled to begin on the 4th of October, and the judge remanded Robin in custody until then. There was no real update in the case until the end of September, when it was announced that Robin was being released on bail. It was revealed that a potential murder weapon had been discovered, a 58-centimetre metal bar. It was discovered near the post office back in March, but it was never publicly released. Robin was released on bail while prosecutors conducted additional testing of the metal bar. Mr. Justice Calvert Smith also agreed to postpone the trial for the additional testing to be conducted. During a court hearing, it was revealed that the metal bar did not have Robin's DNA on it. A forensic examination of the weapon showed samples of Diana's DNA at one end and DNA of an unknown male at the other end, as well as a mixture of both types of DNA in the middle. Following the hearing, it was announced that Robin would be released from Holme House Prison in Stockton, where he was being held, and would be living at an address outside of the area. Robin had staunchly denied any involvement in his wife's murder, and he had a plethora of supporters who showed up at the court. Outside of court, Barrister Hill said, "The report is consistent with someone else being the murderer, which is the defendant's case." In March the following year, Robin stood trial for Diana's murder. During opening statements, Prosecutor David Hatton revealed that when paramedics arrived at the scene, they found that blood had matted in Diana's hair and that rigor mortis had already set in. Rigor mortis is the third stage of death and is characterized by stiffening of the limbs. It occurs as soon as 4 hours after death. The rigor mortis was evidence that Diana had been dead for some time. Paramedics also detected hypostasis, which is blood pooling in tissue, after the heart had stopped. They estimated that Diana had died within about 30 minutes after the attack. She had sustained 3 blows to the head with some kind of rod-like weapon. He also revealed that in regards to the robbery at the post office the year beforehand, Robin had reported that £10,000 was stolen. However, Prosecutor Hatton said that nobody saw anything suspicious on that occasion and that no arrests were ever made. That £10,000 was reimbursed by the post office. Prosecutor Hatton put forward the theory that Robin was struggling with mounting debts and believed that Diana was cheating on him. He said that a tangled background of infidelity and financial problems was the motivation behind the murder of Diana. According to Prosecutor Hatton, the couple had maintained a facade of being happy and financially comfortable. However, in reality, they were on the verge of breaking up, and Robin had built up £30,000 of credit card debt simply because he was living beyond his means. In a bid to combat his debts, Robin had been taking money from the post office, he alleged. He stated, "The pressure, tension and ill feeling erupted, we suggest in extreme violence, in which Robin killed his wife." He also said that after killing his wife, Robin staged the robbery as a way to conceal the truth. Prosecutor Hatton said that while first off, Diana was excited to work with her husband in the post office, over time she had become disenchanted. She had been trained to be the postmistress, but over recent years she had left the work to Robin, who went to bed early and woke up at 4 a.m. each morning to open up the shop. Customers remarked that it was Robin who was always the friendly face behind the counter at the post office and at the shop, but many said that they didn't know Diana and rarely saw her. He said that Diana had confessed to Robin that she had slept with another man in December of 2008, while her husband slept upstairs, and had been on a dating website where her profile said that she was looking for a man aged between 35 to 50. It was also revealed that Diana had kissed a cousin's husband at a family gathering, and had exchanged flirtatious messages with a local man she cycled with at night when Robin was asleep. Prosecutor Hatton said, their conversations on Facebook would have a sexual tone, telling each other what they would like to do to each other if they were alone together. The prosecutor took the jury through the morning of the murder and what Robin claimed had happened. He said that at 8:30 a.m. when Robin claimed the robbery had taken place, the village was teeming with school children and their parents, as well as residents going to work. He said that nobody saw anything suspicious that morning, and nobody saw anybody leave the post office. She said that the post office safe had a timed lock, which meant that it couldn't be opened until after an alarm sounded at 8:30 a.m. Robin had told police that he was serving a customer when he heard the alarm, and that when they left, the killer burst in from the living quarters. According to the prosecutor, there were only 79 seconds between the alarm sounding in the shop and Robin phoning 999. As mentioned earlier, a metal pipe was discovered with Diana's DNA on one end and unknown male DNA on the other end. During trial, it was revealed that the pipe had been found by police on top of a wall opposite the post office. Rust fragments matching the pipe were found, matted in Diana's hair and on the bed. The prosecution suggested that the other man's DNA belonged to the police officer who discovered the weapon. According to forensic experts, Diana had been murdered at some point between 2:30 a.m. and 4:30 a.m. The night before, the couple had eaten fish and chips for dinner at around 8:30 p.m. Diana's autopsy showed that the food was only partially digested, with digestion stopping when she died around 6 to 8 hours later. Robin had told police that when he woke up that morning to open up the store, Diana was still asleep in bed. He said that at some point around 6 a.m, he heard two thuds coming from upstairs in the living quarters, but said that he thought that it was Diana going to the bathroom. Prosecutor Hatton told the jury to consider the likelihood of a robber and killer killing Diana and then waiting 4 to 6 hours to go downstairs and rob the post office. It was also disclosed that the night before Diana was murdered, Robin had tried to buy £850 worth of goods from a cash and carry, but the transaction was refused and then the bank called Diana. According to a witness, they had seen Robin walking on the green, carrying a bag. The prosecutor stated, where could he go? He had nothing. He returned. The pressure, tension, and ill feeling erupted in extreme violence, in which Robin killed his wife. The prosecution also stated there was evidence that Diana had been going through the books, and that Robin knew that they were going to America on holiday just a week later, and he knew that a relief postmistress would be coming in to run the business in their absence. The prosecution suggested that the relief postmistress would have carried out an audit, and any discrepancies in the money would have come to light. Following the prosecution's case, a number of friends were allowed to testify in regards to the couple's marriage. Their description of the couple would vary substantially from the portrait that the prosecution had presented. Bernard Golding told the courtroom that he had become good friends with the couple over the years, and said that they often went to the local pub for a meal together or have dinner parties. He said that the couple were very loving and affectionate, and over the 8 years he had known them, he had never heard them say a cross word to one another. He described Robin as being quite jokey, while Diana used to love telling stories and was very bubbly. Bernard spoke about the earlier robbery of the post office and said that in the aftermath, Robin was a bundle of nerves. He'd always look up when the door opened. Bernard also said that after the murder, he had spotted a packet of cigarettes with only 3 missing, and a glove beside the road near the post office. Bernard reported these items to police, but said that the items were still there around a month later. Linda Ling, who worked part-time at the shop, said that both Robin and Diana were a lovely couple who had both been very kind to her. She said, "I always thought he thought the world of her," before saying that in 2009, Robin paid for his wife to go to Glastonbury in a camper van with a friend. Linda Sharp, who also worked part-time at the shop, said that the couple were always together. Testimony was also heard from other locals who were in and around the shop on the morning of the murder. Sheert Dodson, who lived just 2 doors away from the post office, said that he was in the shop that morning at around 5:05 a.m. and said that Robin appeared to be his normal self. Milkman David Harper was in the shop around 10 minutes later and said that Robin was his usual, friendly, affable, personable self. According to Maureen Roper, however, she said that when she came into the shop at 8:25 a.m, Robin wasn't his normal self. She testified, "Normally, he joked about how many cigarettes I bought, but this time, he was quiet." Testimony from the locals was followed by testimony from PC Mark Reed. He said that he arrived at the post office after Robin had called 999. He went upstairs to find Diana evidently dead in the bedroom. He said that Robin appeared to be shell-shocked when he tried to talk to him. He said that they went downstairs to the kitchen where he gave Robin a glass of water. PC Reed said that Robin was very vague when he described what had happened, testifying, "He would sob occasionally, but there didn't seem to be any tears." He said that he and a colleague later drove Robin to the police station. He said that there was no conversation in the car, but at one point during the drive, Robin said, "Why was her back still warm?" The very first police officer on the scene had been PC Christopher Marlowe. He told the courtroom that he'd been led up to the bedroom by neighbour Pauline Dye, as the paramedics followed behind him. He testified that when he informed Robin that rigor mortis had already set in, Robin said, "How can that be? She's still warm." Consultant neuropathologist Dr. Daniel DePlice took the courtroom through the injuries that had been inflicted on Diana. He said that she suffered 3 wounds to the head. One was on top of her head, another was on the left above her ear, and the third was on the right of her head. He said that she would have died within minutes as opposed to within hours. In fact, he said that the injuries were so severe that death could have been almost instant, adding that it was extremely unlikely that Diana remained conscious after the attack. He said, "Blows like this would almost certainly result in loss of consciousness, and that would have been almost immediate." Photographs of the bloodstained pillow were entered as evidence while the murder weapon, a metal pipe, was passed around the jury. Dr. Stuart Hamilton, the pathologist who examined Diana, said that it was impossible to precisely determine what time Diana died at. He explained that pathologists will use 3 factors in determining a time of death, and that was the body temperature, the degree of rigor mortis and hypostasis, which is the settling of blood which causes skin discoloration. He said that Diana was most likely asleep when she was attacked, because there was no defensive injuries. He said, "In my view, she had been dead at least an hour at the time she was found, and I think it more likely that she had been dead since the early morning hours of March 23rd. Under cross-examination by defence barrister Jamie Hill, Dr. Hamilton accepted that there was a reasonable chance that Diana actually died later than that. Despite the fact that the murder was very brutal, forensic scientist Joanna Millington, who was an expert in blood staining, said that it was possible that Diana's killer may not have gotten blood on themselves. Testimony was presented in relation to the DNA found on the murder weapon. It was revealed that the unknown male DNA actually belonged to PC Darren Thompson. After it was discovered that it was his DNA, he was questioned in regards to his movements on that day. He He said that he had found the weapon and had guarded it for around half an hour until it was photographed by crime scene photographers. Under cross-examination by Defence Hill, DC Thompson said he knew that by touching the metal pipe, he could have contaminated the item with his own DNA, or could have even accidentally removed someone else's DNA. The metal pipe had been examined by forensic scientist Sarah Gray, who swabbed the bar for DNA 5 months after it was discovered. She said that DC Thompson must have handled the bar or inadvertently coughed or spat over it while talking. It also emerged during trial that just hours after Diana was killed, a balaclava and a gun was found behind a club in Thornaby Teesside. Police in that area were informed of the discovery, but DNA testing was never conducted. According to Defence Hill, this was because the police had already focused on Robin as a suspect. Three men who all had intimate relationships with Diana were also called to testify during the trial. John Illingworth told the court that the Garbutts were staying with friends at the house he was sharing in York in December of 2008. He said that they had all gone out drinking separately, but when they returned home, he ended up on the sofa with Diana after her male friend and Robin had gone upstairs to their respective beds. He told the jury, "We were intimate on the settee. It was very cloudy because we were both very drunk." He said that Diana later told him that she had confessed to Robin what had happened. He asked Diana if he should expect a visit from Robin, to which Diana replied, "Robin's not like that. He's not physical." Local man Craig Hall told the courtroom that he was going through a divorce with his wife when he and Diana had what he described as cheeky banter on Facebook about sex. He went on late-night bike rides with Diana, but claimed that they never had a physical relationship. He said that Diana had confided in him that her marriage was going through a rough patch, and that Robin was considering paying for her to rent somewhere in the village for her to stay for a while. His testimony was followed by testimony from Kevin Hebe, the ex-husband of Diana's cousin. He said that they had a kiss following a family party in North Wales, and said that in the aftermath, he and his wife, who was Diana's cousin, separated. During the murder trial, more information regarding Robin's version of events was revealed. During his interview with police, he had initially said that the killer fled through the front door, before later claiming that he fled through the back door. When he was asked what he said to the killer when he said he had his wife, he said he couldn't remember, stating, "I hope I said, look after Di, but for the life of me, I can't remember." Robin had also told police that he worried that Diana may have done something stupid and that she was the type of person who would put up a fight. Robin also testified during the trial. The prosecution were given the opportunity to cross-examine him, and they said, "You had an unhappy, unfaithful wife who didn't love you and found you to be inadequate. Do you agree?" Robin said that this statement was totally untrue. The prosecution then stated, "If she left, you would lose your future and your shop." To which Robin said, "I wouldn't know what agreements we would make on that." Photographs had been taken inside the couple's bedroom, which showed that the wardrobe was open. Robin claimed that they had begun packing for their trip to the United States, but the prosecution suggested that instead, Diana was planning on leaving Robin. Following his testimony, Robin's mother, Joyce Brooke, testified. She told the quiet courtroom how Robin was the only man that Diana ever trusted, and denied that they were trapped in a sham marriage. She said that Diana had been involved in violent relationships before her relationship with Robin, and that she often described her husband as a top guy. She said that she had shared a meal with the couple a week before the murder, and said that everything seemed to be normal, describing them as very happy, joking, sitting side by side, having a meal, just as they always did. The defence called on several other witnesses to testify in regards to the relationship between Diana and Robin, all of whom said that they appeared to have a loving relationship. Rosalind Sheddon, who founded a book club with Diana and went to Glastonbury with her in 2009, described Robin as a gentle person, stating, "He liked to see everybody else happy over himself." Another local man, Brian Hurd, said that he was in the post office shop that morning at around 6:45 a.m. when he heard a woman's voice calling out Robin's name. When Robin had testified earlier, he mentioned that his wife had called out to him twice that morning. However, he had failed to mention this to police when he was originally interviewed. Following all of the testimony, the defence said that the police had cherry-picked the evidence to fit their theory that Diana was killed by Robin. He stated, "You can't just cherry-pick the evidence. You can't just ignore the parts of the evidence you don't like in order to put forward a theory. I'm going to suggest that the prosecution case is nothing more than that, a theory." He reminded the juries that a patron of the shop had heard a woman calling out to Robin that morning, stating, "If it's right, if it might be right, Mr. Garbutt couldn't possibly have killed his wife." He said that at the crime scene, a neighbour had been allowed to wash Diana's blood off her hands, while the murder weapon was handled by a police officer. He accused police of botching the crime scene and mishandling it, stating that their mistakes could be likened to a comedy of errors, if they weren't so serious for his client. Prosecutor Hatton refuted this, and said that the evidence had bordered on the absurd. He said that there was only one conclusion, and that was that there had been no robbery at the post office that morning, and that Robin had concocted that story after murdering his wife. Following the closing arguments, the jury were sent away to deliberate. After deliberating for more than 13 hours, they rejected Robin's claims of an armed intruder, and instead found him guilty of Diana's murder. As the verdict was read out, Robin shook his head as his sister collapsed in tears and Diana's mother wept. Robin Garbutt was sentenced to life in prison and was ordered to serve a minimum of 20 years. In handing down the sentence, Mr. Justice Openshaw said that Robin's lies had been exposed as pure humbug. He said that Robin showed no remorse over his wife, adding that he always accompanied his lies with sanctimonious lies of his love for his wife. The judge said that he believed that the murder was motivated by Robin's fear of being exposed for stealing money from the post office. In a statement outside court, DC John Bosomworth read out a statement which Agnes had written.
"Diana meant the world to us, and we are still struggling to come to terms with what happened to her on that awful day. Diana was a beautiful and caring girl, and we loved her with all our hearts. Our loss is unbearable. The past year has been a very traumatic time for us all. We are very relieved that justice has now been carried out for Diana and for everyone who knew and loved her. We can never bring Diana back, but our cherished memories of her will never fade. We are aware of the enormous amount of work carried out to secure justice for Diana. We would like to thank everyone involved in the investigation and prosecution for their commitment and compassion throughout this difficult time."
Following the verdict, Agnes would buy the post office where her daughter was murdered and turn it into a home. The following year, Robin applied for a case review. His solicitor submitted documents to the Criminal Cases Review Commission, and according to his family, the files had taken more than 2 years to put together and contained new evidence. Robin, who still continued to profess his innocence, had garnered a number of supporters who believed that he had been wrongfully convicted of Diana's murder. Then in 2020, Robin applied once more for his case to be reviewed. The year beforehand, the post office had admitted that they had gotten things wrong when dealing with a number of postmasters, and were ordered to pay £58 million to settle the dispute. This came after 550 claimants joined a civil action to win compensation, alleging that the Horizon IT system, which had been installed between 1999 and 2000, had a number of defects and issues which led to people being wrongfully accused of fraud. It was the Horizon IT system which had apparently showed that Robin had been stealing money from the post office. Robin supporters had hoped that this would work in Robin's favour, since during the trial he had been accused of stealing from the post office. A website titled Robin Garbutt Official Website has been set up, where Robin supporters post updates. They wrote in March of 2020 that they were preparing to submit new evidence to the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which had been set up in the wake of the miscarriage of justice scandals. Then in August, they wrote that they had finally submitted the new evidence, after being held up because of COVID. They wrote that one of the main points that the prosecution relied on was evidence from the post office specialists to try and implicate Robin in money going missing from the post office. However, they had no actual proof of this. They additionally said that the Criminal Cases Review Commission had sent back 45 cases to the Court of Appeal, wherein evidence from the post office could not be relied on. It read in part, "If this is the case, then surely the evidence against Robin must be deemed unreliable, thus removing the case for theft from the equation. If this is the case, then there is no case against Robin, as the prosecution always maintained whoever stole the money killed Di." The website also acknowledged that there was a clump of hair seen on the pillow beside Diana and was photographed. They say that the colour of the hair was not the same as Diana's or Robin's, and that police somehow lost the clump of hair. Even more questionable, lamps that may have contained blood spatter were hidden away in a wardrobe by somebody and never DNA tested. This is a complex case that seemingly has more questions than answers. For example, why would an intruder beat a sleeping woman to death and then leave her husband, who was a witness, alive? Why was Diana's dinner not digested, and why did she have rigor mortis if she were still alive when Robin woke up like he had claimed? Why would a killer dispose of the murder weapon just a few feet from the crime scene? Furthermore, how did nobody in the busy village centre see or hear a thing? On the other hand, there was a witness who heard Diana calling out to Robin that morning. And why was Robin's DNA not on the murder weapon? Why did Robin have no blood on his clothing when the murder was a particularly brutal one? The murder of Diana Garbutt not only devastated the lives of her family, it also plunged a close-knit, quaint community into a state of fear. Many people still question whether this case was a miscarriage of justice. That's not for me to decide, but what is evident is that there are a number of holes in the case that could be cleared up with a review. It's also evident that the crime scene was extremely mishandled, and potentially police working on the case had tunnel vision. The case is currently under review by the Criminal Cases Review Commission, and I'll make sure to keep you informed on social media of any updates. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Carla, William and Hannah Parr, and Naomi. In return for your support on Patreon, you get exclusive Morbidology merch, exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, ad-free early release episodes, and of course, my undying love. You can even request a case for me to cover on the podcast. You can join for as little as $1 a month, and you can cancel any time. Can I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Trace Evidence. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hey, this is Stephen Pacheco, the host of Trace Evidence, a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. Each week, I explore a different unsolved case and take a deep dive into the victim, the events leading up to the crime, every fact we know, every question we're left with, and then a breakdown of the most popular theories revolving around that case. Each Monday, a new episode comes out, and there are more than 80 episodes of mysterious and fascinating cases to catch up on, some you've heard, and many that you haven't. If you're drawn to deep examinations of some of the most mysterious cases, give Trace Evidence a listen. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcatchers. Visit trace-evidence.com for more information, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.